they say, we're not getting the word out. The communication, it's not our strategy, we're not getting the word out. Let's talk about what's going on in Iraq, and we can use the words of George Will and William F. Buckley, two men I'm sure you respect as a conservative. That's fair, right?
I've read them over the years.
Okay. Is it fair that you respect both men? Because I do, even though I'm a liberal. I respect both men.
They've written some fine pieces, and I won't say anything tonight to disparage their contributions to the effort or even about what they've said.
Well, let's talk about what they say, because you say that part of it is a communication problem. And one of the people that we have, George Will, cites Michael Rubin. Actually, he's been a previous guest on this show. He's with the American Enterprise Institute. Mm-hmm. He's been a great guest. He's a guy who actually goes on the ground in Iraq, speaks all the languages, and takes a lot of risks as an American, frankly, reporting on them.
Right.
He reports in the Wall Street Journal, again, not any liberal icon, in the Wall Street Journal that Shiite militias have broken up co-ed picnics, executed barbers for the sin of shaving beards, and liquor store owners, instituted their own courts outside of the courts of Iraq. They have their own courts, and posted religious guards in front of girls' schools to ensure Iranian-style dress. In other words, they don't cover themselves, that they're going to have guards that force them to do this. Obviously, this isn't a good sign, and this isn't a question about communication. This is some severe sectarian violence, religious violence, going on in Iraq.
Yes, there are some difficulties going on now, and I think the key thing on this is that the criminals who are doing this are not able to operate on their own. What they're doing is they're operating simply in a situation where they have to hit and run. If they could control the streets, they'd be in good shape, but they're not controlling the streets. They're doing it hit and run. And so for that reason, they're really no better, no worse than common criminals that we'll see any place in America or any place else.
Let me give our listeners a chance to call in. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-MARK. We welcome your contributions. Feel free to agree with me, to agree with Mike, to disagree with both of us. It's your show. This is live TV. Mike, it seems to me that we're on the verge of civil war. I actually predicted this a year ago. We would head to civil war. You pointed out before the show, we're not quite there yet. And I'll accept that we're not in open civil war yet.
But incipient was your word.
But it was my word, but we're getting there. Three quarters of all deaths in Iraq by violence are executions. They're not even, you know, people fighting in the streets. They're people taking people and executing them. And what's interesting is it's not just the Sunnis who are afraid of the Shiites or the majority who are generally opposed to the American occupation. It's the Shiites, too. Some support American occupation, some don't. But they're going out and they're killing the Sunnis. And here's how I see Iraq, and I want to know if you agree with me. I see Iraq much like Yugoslavia was.
Mm-hmm.
Yugoslavia, for many years, was controlled by a dictator, Marshal Tito. He was a pretty ruthless dictator.
He was.
But he kept the Croatians and the Serbians and the people of Bosnia from killing each other. When he left the scene, it erupted into civil war,
right,
and to some extent, genocide.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that Saddam Hussein served the same purpose. Authoritarian dictator, no question. Ruthless, no question. But with him gone, it's now dividing up into the three countries that I think Iraq, heck, always should have been. You have Kurdistan in the north, the Sunni triangle, Shiites in the south. They were all put together by the British, who drew straight line boundaries after World War I. If the people of Iraq want to partition the country into three separate nations and fight it out in a brutal civil war, what the heck are we doing there?
Well, you're right. Historically, Iraq was created by the British after World War I, where they just drew artificial boundaries and didn't pay attention to traditional tribal things. So you've got a situation where it took something along the lines of a strong man like Saddam Hussein, in the mold of Marshal Tito, who was able to hold it together through sheer terror and brute force. There were not natural alliances and natural allegiances there. Now that he's not there and we're trying to allow them to discover democracy and to live for and plan their own future, the question is, are they better off as three or are they better off as one? I think most international experts will argue they're better off as one and not as three, because if we can convince them to live with each other and to go the civil route rather than the civil war route, number one, it's much more stable for the region. But number two, the people who have been the good guys on our side, backing us the whole time on this, the Kurds up north, have the potential for turning into the bad guys if they're turned loose on their own, because they've always dreamed of a country called Kurdistan, and there are large populations of Kurds in Turkey and large populations of Kurds in Iran, and as they try and create their Kurdistan that they've always dreamed of, you could wind up with a civil war in Turkey as a result of that, which is something we really don't want to go down that road.
Mike, I disagree with you.
Okay.
I have argued actually for 15 years, long back before I had this show, before I was in Congress, back when George Bush, who I felt should have gone all the way to Baghdad, I have argued that the Kurds should have a separate country. They could make it in Iraq. I think actually they could sign a deal with Turkey where they say, we will forswear the Kurdish holdings in Turkish lands if Turkey recognizes an independent Kurdistan and allows for autonomy, meaning, you know, Kurds in Turkey have the right to have their language in schools, but still within Turkey. But to me, the broader geopolitical question is not whether it should be three or one. I think we can debate that. But shouldn't the Iraqis decide? And sometimes these things are decided by force. The reason why the boundaries in Europe, I dare say, are not generally straight lines, but are generally jagged edges, is because Europe was divided by culture, by religion. They fought myriads of wars until they finally ended up with states that were more or less homogeneous. You know, the French were in one area, the Germans in another. They fought on the border. But it seems to me that because of the arbitrary imperialist boundaries set by the British, they haven't done this. And my view, I guess, is if the people want one country, fine. If they want three countries, fine. What I don't want is American men and women stuck in the crossfire of what I think is an incipient civil war.
Well, the jury's out as to what they're going to decide. I think if I can bring up one of your articles, the one by George Will, he points out that the vast majority of Iraqis, be they Sunni, Shia, or Kurds, are buying into this concept of one Iraq. They really see a civil organization, a way of getting along, a way of keeping the peace, and a way of all living together the way they did with a democratic government as the way to go. What he points out is that there have, you know, back in the Soviet Union, they were all happy doing what they were doing at the same time, too, and it was a very, very small minority of Bolsheviks who fomented the revolution and changed the country and took it over and imposed totalitarian government over there. They were successful. It was a small number of people. The question is, are we going to allow the same tiny percentage of people to do in Iraq what the Bolsheviks were able to do in the Soviet Union? But Mr. Will's primary point is the vast majority of people have bought into this peaceful one government for all three types of Iraqis.
Actually, I think the Soviet Union is another good example, because when communism fell, it also divided into Russia and Georgia and Ukraine and Kazakhstan and had a brutal battle over Chechnya. Here's my question. If the people of Iraq want to stay together, you know, God or Allah bless them. Mm-hmm. I hope they succeed. But there are plenty of governments all over the earth where you have people and small minorities in control. The Alawite government of Syria, Assad, controls a very small sect. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of dictators all over the world, all kinds of nasty dictators. We got rid of one authoritarian dictator. It cost us hundreds of billions of dollars. At least 2,000 Americans are dead already and counting. 10,000 Americans are wounded, already and counting. Tens of thousands of Iraqis are dead already and counting. And the question is, sure, you know, it'd be nice to remake the world in our image. It'd be nice to invade every country where you have a dictator ruling. But it seems to me, I don't know, kind of reminds me of the old Iran-Iraq war back in the early 80s. You had two vicious, awful governments doing vicious, awful things to each other. And I guess my view was, you know, I want to concentrate on things that harm America. I mean, if you want to concentrate on Iran, which is developing nuclear weapons, fine. Or North Korea, fine. Or Osama bin Laden, absolutely. They're a threat to us. We just don't have the manpower. We don't have the recruits to be the policemen of every conflict in the world. It seems to me Iraq is a mess, and maybe it's time to get out.
Well, you make a good argument, and I'm not going to say that it doesn't hold some credibility and some weight. But what we find ourselves in a situation now is where the majority of the people want to hold together. And if we abandon them and let the terrorists, you know, slash Bolshevik, modern-day Bolsheviks, whatever they are, if we let them take over, there's no doubt that they are the modern-day representatives of al-Qaeda in Iraq right now. And that means that Osama bin Laden, the guy who is you know, lucky to find a cave to sleep in at night, and has to get up and move every 4 hours because we're on his tail in either Afghanistan or Pakistan. It means he's going to have a free sanctuary to set up shop and continue to plot against us in Iraq. The question really comes down to the safety of the American people, the safety and security of the American people. We didn't just go to Iraq to get rid of a brutal dictator. We went to Iraq to make it a less of a threat, a more stable area, by getting rid of this crackpot who was running the country and was threatening us with weapons of mass destruction. Now that he's gone, the threshold question is, are we going to leave it an unstable morass where Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden can set up shop? Or are we going to stay the course and make sure that we leave it a stable environment where it spreads stability throughout the region? I favor stability.
Mike, you're dreaming.
No, I'm not.
You're dreaming. It's great. No. I would love a stable Iraq. I'd love a stable Middle East. I would love it if all the oil in Saudi Arabia were right here in Virginia and Maryland, and we could do it. But that's not the way the world is. You said leave Iraq a stable place. That's
a more
false.
Stable place than it is now.
Iraq has never been stable. In fact, the most stable point in Iraq over the last 15 years was the 10 years it was controlled by Saddam Hussein. It was far more stable then than it is. Well, 20, fine. But far more stable then than it is now. Iraq is an unstable place. And I guess I have a problem with
it. It wasn't stable. When he carried on that 9-year war against Iran, you can't call that stable.
Okay.
You can't call that
That's
stable.
That's why I said the last 10
All
years.
Right.
But here's my point. You're saying the terrorists. To me, that hides the ball, and I think the administration does as well. The terrorists. Who are the terrorists? Hold on.
Okay.
Al-Zarqawi. But Al-Zarqawi is not a major player here. You have Sunnis killing Shiites. You have Shiites killing Sunnis. You have the government of Iraq having its own death squads. You have, most of them are local. Al-Zarqawi is a very, very minor player. You have an all-out civil war. Would Al-Zarqawi like to get his hands on it? Of course he would, but he's a minor player here. You have people fighting people. And it seems to me that it's not about Al-Zarqawi any more than it's about all the other Al-Qaeda operatives and all the other Arab countries on earth, including Iran. The problem is we're in the middle of a civil war. And I know you have a response, but I need to take a break, and I want to give our callers a chance to join in. Right. Folks, if you want to join in this discussion, again, agree or disagree with myself or Mike, you're welcome to do so. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-MARK. The local number is right there on the screen. Join us in the discussion, and we'll be right back with the Inside Scoop right after this.
Mr. DeBruzzo, I'm Ed McMahon, and we're signing up people for...
Yes,
Mr. Murphy, Ed McMahon. We're starting up. No,
Dreams
no.
really do
be
come
it,
true.
Hombre, dinero. Dinero.
Yes,
Ed
McMahon.
Yes, Ed McMahon.
Yes, Ed McMahon. We're having our first
Ed
ever.
Ed McMahon.
Yes. Tuesday night at the high school. We're starting up the neighborhood watch in this area, and here's all the information.
Stevie, get down here, please.
No, he's just here. It's just...
six, seven, eight.
No tango, Danero. Neighborhood watch. We're having this neighborhood watch, the first one.
Right. Larry, put some pants on.
I'll come back.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Start a neighborhood watch. It's just one of the many ways you can help make America stronger. To find out how, call or log on for this free guide.
When I was young, my dad always told me to dream big and dream often.
My mom and dad were always my biggest cheerleaders.
I've been very fortunate to have parents that care, but some kids aren't so lucky.
That's why the Major League Baseball players trust for children.
Same with Volunteers of America, to help kids everywhere.
For more than 100 years, Volunteers of America has helped children, families, and many others rebuild their lives.
Our Share with a Child partnership wants you to give kids your time, guidance, and support.
Work together to give every child a chance. Find out how you can help a child dream big.
Call 1-800-899-0089 or visit volunteersofamerica.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing the incipient civil war in Iraq. My guest is Mike Lane. He's the president of Intelligent Strategies. And if you want to call in and join the debate, feel free to do so. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK. The local number is right there on your screen. Some of you I know like to write in your points rather than call them in. Just go to radioinsidescoop.com, comment on the blog, and we'll read some of your questions on the air. Mike, I'd like to read from you from William F. Buckley's article. It's about a week or two old now. And he talks about the fact that the Sunnis are blaming not the Shiites, but America.
Right.
And the Shiites aren't blaming the Sunnis. They're blaming America. I can quote, I can tell you the main reason behind all our woes, it is America. Our mission has failed, William F. Buckley writes, because Iraqi animosities have proved uncontainable by an invading army of 130,000 Americans. An American soldier was anonymously cited saying he could understand why Saddam Hussein was needed to keep the Sunnis and the Shiites from each other's throats. William F. Buckley writes, and the administration has now to cope with failure. He ends his article by saying, and the kernel here is the acknowledgement of defeat. You have George Will saying that when violence surges, if U.S. forces take the lead in suppressing it, in other words, if we act hard and tough against them, we are blamed for being too violent. And if we don't act, we're blamed for being the occupying force and not in control of the land. We are in a catch-22. And I have to tell you, Mike, I don't think it's al-Zaqqari. There's a specific example of a government emergency office where people are supposed to call, like a 911,
right,
if there's a problem. And what happens, people call in, their numbers are on the screen, just like our 911, so that you can go out there. And those numbers are being sold to people who will then go out and kill the caller. Because the government is filled with these death threats, these people who are out killing people. I mean, you have a government that's not in control. Mm-hmm. You have people killing people. And I have to tell you, 90% plus of it, they're locals. Now, I'm not saying that all Iraqis are out killing each other. I know that's not true. But the ones who are doing the damage, I'm afraid, al-Zaqqari, I'm sure he's happy, but he's not fomenting this. These are Sunnis wanting control, Shiites wanting control, and I got to know what we're doing there.
Well, you're right. The government is not as in control as it should be. But let's get back to what George Will and Bill Buckley were writing first. You correctly pointed out that they're arguing that we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. If we go in to stop the violence, then we have too heavy a footprint. And
right.
If we don't go in to stop the violence, then what are we doing there? You know, we're the occupying force and we're not keeping the peace.
That's right.
Well, our strategy has always been to let the Iraqis stand up, and we stand down as the Iraqis stand up. Well, they've got a lot more abilities now and a lot more capability to do that, but they're not perfect, as we're not perfect. And we were not able to keep 100% of the peace while we were doing it all as well. But from my perspective, and obviously from the administration's perspective, we're better off letting the Iraqis go out there, as flawed as they might be, and doing the best job to keep the peace. And they're going to make mistakes as we made mistakes, and they're going to have failures as we had failures. But to suggest that this violence is not being fanned and fermented by al-Zaqqari and al-Qaeda, who do you think it was that brought down that mosque with the gold dome?
I'm sure they're pleased. And that was what started
the current.
But you know, I remember
cycle.
Back when Yasser Arafat, when Ariel Sharon visited the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and Yasser Arafat used that as an excuse, purely an excuse to begin a second intifada. Okay. Now, Yasser Arafat, no question, put the spark to the flame. He started the spark, but the gasoline was already there. People were already angry. Al-Qaeda may be the spark, but the flame is the Iraqi people themselves. And that's why I think that the Iraqi army will never step up to the plate as long as it's being, as George Will called it, infantilized, acting like a baby, because it always depends on America. I do have a caller on the line. I don't know whether he agrees with you or me, but Joe from Reston, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here. My question is really, or just looking for you folks to comment, is one thing that looks clear is the American people, to me, don't seem to be reacting to what they see every day on the television screens. Is it because they become desensitized to all the violence when you look at all the burning buildings, people being blown up and killed every day? At what point does the American people have a more significant reaction? To me, obviously, approval ratings don't seem to be able to go much lower. People's dissatisfaction doesn't seem to be able to go much higher. So where does it all go from here?
Well, in my view, there may be some desensitization going on, but I do think that, frankly, they don't cover Iraq near as much as they used to. Back when George Bush was flaunting himself on a battleship saying mission accomplished, you heard from Iraq every day, you had people embedded in there, and you had, it was like a video game. Boom, 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 blow up, we're winning. I actually think the press is covering it a lot less, since we have the fact that at least William F. Buckley is willing to face, but the administration isn't, and that is that we're losing in Iraq. It seems to me, though, I'll tell you one big difference, Joe, and then I'll let Mike have his say. I think the difference between this war and Vietnam is very simple. In Vietnam, with the draft, we had Americans of all walks of life losing their sons, mostly sons, there may have been a few daughters, but mostly sons in Vietnam. And so people of all walks of life were angry. People like George Bush, Dick Cheney, their family members aren't in Iraq. Most members of Congress aren't family members in Iraq. You know, I think that because this war is being fought by poor people who, in our volunteer army, which I support, you know, I think that's one reason why Americans probably aren't taking the streets as much as they should. Mike?
Well, I don't know about taking to the streets, but Joe, I would argue that there is a sensitivity, an understanding on the part of the American people, and that it is being covered. And what you see resulting in the polls now is the fact that people are reacting to what they see. I don't know. Every morning when I wake up, I turn on the news, and all I hear is, weather and sports and traffic coming up, but our lead headline is 4 more dead in explosions in Iraq this morning. And I hear that every single morning. And the fact that you see numbers that are as low as they are in the polls for, I think Mark cited 29% that thinks it's worth it, is the fact that they're getting this daily dose and have been getting this daily dose of this for several years now. So I think the American people are sensitive to it. You know, if you want to ask, you know, where are the demonstrations, 50,000, 100,000 people out in the mall, in the streets of Washington or any other city, I don't know where they are. I guess it's because I don't know about that. Maybe the opposition isn't as intense as it was in Vietnam. It obviously hasn't gone on as long. Remember, Vietnam was a war that went 8-10 years. This is a war that's only been 3 years into it, and there is, unlike Vietnam, there is a light that some of us see at the end of the tunnel. I think Mark probably says there is no light here, but we have a national unity government that's supposed to stand up in about 60 days. And if indeed they can get that national unity government to do it, and there's some doubt that the current president designate or president elect or a president whatever he is, Jafari, he might not be the guy. They're talking now about getting rid of him and finding somebody else who will be better at this. But it seems to me that the people are paying attention and they do see this light.
Thank you for your call, Joe. If you want to call in, the toll free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-MARK. Feel free to join in the debate. Mike, look, you mentioned the government. You mentioned al-Jafari, the prime minister. Now, he is in league with Iran.
Right.
He was put in power by no less than al-Sadr, the guy that was on TV, the one that killed the four Americans in Fallujah, right? Mm-hmm. The one that our biggest enemy there put the guy in power. He's the one that, to the extent that there are death squads in the government, they are enforcing, that women have to wear the veil, that they're going to kill barbers and people in liquor stores. These are the people in control. These are the people that the Iraqi people voted for. If al-Jafari stays in power 60 days from now, listen, I'm hopeful he will leave too. Let me tell you something. I had a discussion with Senator Joe Biden just 2 days ago. Joe Biden, as you know, is a Democrat, but who's been pretty supportive of us staying the course in Iraq. He will constantly complain about the way Bush executed the war.
He thought we should have had more troops.
He thought we executed it wrong.
Right.
But he defended that our troops should still be there and stay the course. He told me, and this is an inside scoop for you folks, he told me that if in 60 days it doesn't happen, if they don't have in the defense and the interior ministry a minister who can appeal to all religions, mm-hmm. and only a minister that can appeal to the Shiites, he's going to change his mind, and he's going to call now saying, in effect, what William F. Buckley and George Will have said, it is a failure, it's time to go home. So let me ask you, Mike, in 60 days, if we still have an Iraq, an Iranian puppet, someone who's controlled by the theocracy, Shiites in charge, bombing Sunni mosques, then is it finally time to say, you know what, as William F. Buckley said, we failed. We tried. Maybe we didn't try as well as we could have, but we failed.
Well, you're right. The people are key to this whole thing, and giving the people a chance to perform the way they're supposed to is part of it.
In 60 days, Mike...
Hang on. Not in 60 days, but certainly if
three
the
months,
wrong people...
3 months, 4 months, a year?
Let me finish. I was not happy, as no one was happy, when Al-Jafari was named prime minister. As we've discussed, there are efforts underway now to even get rid of him before he even has the chance to form his national unity government. But the key, as Senator Biden has pointed out, is who's going to control the Defense Department and who's going to control the Interior Department. If the Interior Security and Police Forces are free of that kind of interference, and if the Defense Forces are free of that kind of interference, and they have true unity people in there, then I'm willing to give them, you know, a lot more time than 60 days.
And what if they don't?
On the other hand, if we get losers, unacceptable people in there, then let's see if they step up to the plate. I'm not going to cut it off in 60 days. But if they don't show some activity to step
by,
up to the plate...
By, let's say, the November elections.
If they don't step up to the plate by the end of the year, then I would say that we've got a significant problem on our hands.
A significant problem. Are you ready to pull troops out? That's the question.
Depending on the situation, it may be, yeah.
Wow. Now that's surprising for you.
I'm going to have to look at what the overall situation, but depending on the situation, if they don't step up by the end of the year, yeah, we got a problem.
Let's go to the phones. Mike from Falls Church, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Inside Scoop. Thank you, Mike and Mark. The two ends. But question, why is it that we're so intelligent here in the United States, but we have the problems right locally in the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area, and I say inside the area? And, of course, one of the things is I'm a World War II Navy veteran. I've been around the world. I've been 32 years with the Department of Defense, so I know exactly how organizations should repeat work. And the Defense Department, Rumsfeld, is going to look at revamping the Defense Department so it could be more responsible and formidable to control not only locally, but also the efforts that are going to be international.
Mike, what's your point? Are you saying that we don't... I'm not quite sure what you're saying there.
Inside Scoop from Washington. We've got to clean up our own political system here and come to some way of an agreement, so rather than take these polls to find out the division that is hangering, and all we have to do is find a couple of individuals that can run this country. Well, not only the president, but the secretary.
Well, thank you for your call, Mike. I do think we need more oversight in our government. I think we need not just an administration control. I think one of the problems Republicans are going to face in November 2006 is I don't think Americans like one-party government. I don't think they'd like if the Democrats have one-party government either. We do not have enough oversight. We have a Congress that's basically saying, whatever you say, Mr. President. They haven't subpoenaed a single document from this administration. Bush hasn't vetoed a single spending bill of this Congress. They're all in leagues together, and I wouldn't be surprised, Mike, come November, to see Republicans start to desert the president for good reason.
Well, I don't think you can measure the success of any government by how many documents are subpoenaed by the Congress. But having...
Zero, Mike.
Well, right.
The Republicans
exactly.
Subpoenaed 1,000 documents. They were looking over Clinton's shoulder.
Perhaps.
They wanted to know every single woman he was ever with. And here we have a president that tortures people, no documents. We kill people in prisons in Guantanamo Bay, Afghanistan. They go unpunished, no documents. Illegal eavesdropping, no documents. Whatever you think of these policies, shouldn't Congress be looking over the president's shoulder and saying, you know, I'm not so sure about this?
All right. Well, first of all, those accusations about the president torturing people are so ludicrous, Mark, I'm not even going to respond to them.
The president has a policy to allow torture.
Let me get to your real question and to respond to Joe's question, which is the government working? Is it responsive to the people, and is it doing what it should be doing? And Joe, you got a good point. There is problem with any government. It becomes a bureaucratic morass. If people are in there too long, and if they amass too much power, they start to believe their own press releases, and they start to act in a manner that is not always consistent with the best interests of the citizens. I would not accuse the the administration of doing that now, although clearly there are individuals who start doing this. You can look at the case of Congressman Randy Cunningham from California.
Randy took bribes.
He apparently had a price list that
he gave out
to people.
He did have a price list. You know, but see, it seems to me that
that's the kind of thing that needs to be stopped.
Yes, but Republicans are arguing that Randy Cunningham was some exception. That Duke Cunningham, the Dukester, this was the only guy taking bribes. And all the other many people that Jack Abramoff worked with, you know, whether it's Rob Ney of Ohio.
Harry Reid.
No, but Harry didn't get any money from Jack Abramoff. Let's be clear.
Well, he got money directly from Abramoff's clients. You always use the middleman, the bagman.
People give all kinds of money. We know that. It's a problem in our government. People that hired Abramoff gave money. But Abramoff, let's be clear, Mike, only gave his money to Republicans. As far as he was concerned, the Democratic Party could go away. And the problem wasn't...
Oh, he was a Republican.
Of course he was. And that's not
and
the
a crooked
problem.
One. And we're happy he's going to jail.
And Duke Cunningham...
We are very happy
I'm afraid, is just the tip of the iceberg. And we're going to find over the next few months Republicans in a lot of trouble as member after member gets caught for bribery. And my inside scoop is I wouldn't be surprised if the next one in line is Catherine Harris of Florida, who's running for Senate. And I have to tell you, I am happy, very happy, to have Catherine Harris run for Senate from Florida. It's the best thing Democrats could ever have. But we'll discuss that and also take your calls. I know Mike's dying to respond.
Now, for your sake,
I hope you're
right, because you let something out like that if you're not right.
I think she is person B in the indictment of Duke Cunningham. I think she is person B.
I'll tell you why I don't think so. She's personally as wealthy as you and I can ever dream about. Why would she sell a contract for $500,000? It's just not worth it.
Because the same people, Wade Industries, that gave money to Duke Cunningham, bundled it up, gave her a lot of money, asked for something from it, and she gave it to them. And I think that's going to come out over the next few months. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-MARK. We'll take your calls and also go right to the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com right after this.
This is Mommy's bed. Me and Jenny were jumping on it. Mommy's gun fell on the floor. I was a cowboy. Bang, 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 bang. I said, Jenny, wake up, wake up. It's just pretend. But she wouldn't wake up.
If you give me a fish...
If you give someone a fish...
You feed them for a day.
Teach someone to fish.
You feed them for a lifetime.
Give me a fish, and you'll feed me for a day. Teach me to fish, and you'll feed me for a lifetime.
Through Volunteers of America, you can help change lives in your community.
Hey, mister, studied algebra in school and got a better job than I could. You take the last call.
Oh, no, mister. Stuck in an entry-level job because you only learn basic math. I don't have a boss riding my butt like you do, so you take it so you can get back to your desk.
You know, I probably should, but maybe Miss AP Calculus with her $200 haircut in the big office upstairs would like a cup.
Oh, no, mister. What was your name again? Never mind, it doesn't matter. I'm too busy doing important things to care. I just came down for some sweetened stir.
You know, if my limited math abilities weren't keeping me from getting a better job, I'd quit this afternoon.
I don't blame you. But thank goodness you're stuck here because we really need someone to make the coffee.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is Mike Lane. He's the president of Intelligent Strategies. We're discussing whether this incipient civil war in Iraq is likely to cause problems for the Republicans in November 2006 elections. We got a caller on the line. Before I get to him, Mike, do you believe the insurgency is in its last throes, as Dick Cheney said?
Well, it depends on what you mean by last throes. No, I don't believe it's in its last throes. I think they're going to fight for a long time. You look at really the history of this. In the beginning, it was small, and then it grew, and we shouldn't have let it grow. And then it got big. And then over the last 5-6 months, we've really had a lot of success. We've been getting a lot of help from the Iraqi people. The not only number of incidents from the insurgency, but the effectiveness of the insurgency was dropping, and it was dropping measurably, and everything really was on the right track for the last 5-6 months.
Until
then we had the bombing of the Gold Dome Mosque, and
the things
flared up tremendously again, and there and there was a big explosion. Now that the Iraqi people are looking over the abyss and see what a civil war might look like, or they're looking back over their shoulders and seeing what civil cooperation might look like, they have to make the decision. I don't think they've decided to go to civil war.
I see you've been watching Meet the Press. That's the same metaphor that our Joint Chiefs of Staff used. He said they're looking over the abyss and they're going to come back.
I have to admit I stole that
one. Okay, fair enough. But I'm afraid I don't think it's going to happen. I think that, like Yugoslavia, it won't stop until they literally live in separate countries. But let me hear from our caller, Pat from McLean. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Pat Smallgore. I'm visiting a friend here in McLean, and I'm catching your show, and I actually know Mike Lane. He's a great guy, and I really want to applaud you guys for having this kind of format. I'm actually learning a lot listening to your healthy debates and listening to all the things you're discussing, and that's kind
of the
basis of my question. How do we bring back civil debate and civil discourse of all the issues that we see out there? From an outsider's view, I listen and read the press, and I see a lot of distortions in the press and what's going on. I also see a lot of political distortions, possibly on both sides of the parties, about how to make this problem, how to fix this problem, if you will, with Iraq and other parts of the Middle East. So how do we bring civil discourse and really get to the healthy debate in order to make this thing end the right way?
Well, Pat, I really want to thank you for your call and what you have to say. One of the reasons why I like to invite Mike on the Inside Scoop, and he's, I think at this point, my most frequent guest, if I had to add them all up, is because we do have civil debates. We definitely disagree on issues, but we don't take it personally. We don't attack each other personally. It's not about us as people. It's about the debate. And I have to say, Pat, and here I'm going to throw out a Republican zinger, but I think one of the reasons why you're not seeing debates is because this is an administration that does not want a healthy debate. Bush has town hall meetings unlike any other president I ever know of. Maybe you can find an example in history, Mike, but where he only invites people that agree with him, whether it was on Social Security, whether on the war with Iraq, whatever it is, he goes in, he checks at the door, the Secret Service, to see who they are. They've even known to arrest people who disagree with them. I think this country would be better off if we had more civil debates and if the president would come out of his bubble and actually hear from the majority of Americans who disagree with him. But it seems to me that unlike Mike, my good friend here, the president is afraid of healthy debate, and I think that's why we don't see so much of it, Pat.
Well, they don't arrest people who disagree with them. They arrest people who have crashed a party to which they have not been invited. There is a difference. Pat, thank you for calling. I appreciate it. I recognized your voice as soon as you lifted up the phone. I don't know if the TV was in front of you. I did an unprofessional thing and waved at you when I heard your voice. I thank you for calling. Callers who our audience who doesn't know should know that Pat is a civic activist extraordinaire in Arlington. In fact, Pat, are you just the immediate past president or the current president of the Civic Federation?
Not
all
sure.
Right, he's not sure. Okay.
But you know,
it's civil debate.
We haven't had a lot of civil debates. We have Republicans control of everything, and they feel like they don't need to debate their issues.
When you're the president, you've campaigned on an agenda, and what you want to do is you want to move that agenda through the Congress and have it accepted and approved by the American people. And giving people whose objective is to derail your agenda television time at your town hall meetings to come in and tell you why your agenda is wrong is not the way to sell and move your agenda forward.
Mike, with all due respect, Bill Clinton wasn't like that. Bill Clinton,
he
would go to a debate, and if someone disagreed with him, the debate could be ending at 10 p.m., he'd be there at 2 a.m., still trying to convince that person that he was right. Joe Biden, just to give you another example, he stayed at the convention I was at, the talk radio convention, hours later, still trying to talk to each person, trying to convince them. These are people who care about what the people coming at them think. And a lot of people that want to attend the Bush town hall meetings are not people who are certain Bush is wrong, but people who have open minds, who are questioning it. And it seems to me that when you invite people in there, Jon Stewart's done a lot of these on the Daily Show. Oh, Mr. President, how can I help you do your agenda? Mr. President, I pray for you. These are not town hall meetings. If you want to call them Bush propaganda meetings, at least that would be honest. But they're not town hall meetings. Why won't Bush invite the town into his hall?
All right. In the sense of a town hall meeting, I'll agree with you. They are not town hall meetings. What they are is media events to sell a certain concept to the media, and we're not trying to convince the people that are in the room at the time. We're trying to convince the greater television audience who might be seeing either the town hall on C-SPAN or who might be seeing snippets of it on the evening news. They're trying to persuade them that this particular issue and this particular agenda is what is good for America. So I'll concede, these are not town hall meetings in the traditional sense. They're not for the president to hear from the people. They are for the people to hear from the president.
Mike, let me say a dirty little secret here on the inside scoop. I have an agenda. I know you're surprised to hear this, folks. I have an agenda. I work for the Democrats. I work for the Judiciary Committee. I work for the Homeland Security Committee. I believe what I'm saying.
Right.
And I know you believe what you're saying. But I invite you on this show, and I invite all the people on all my debate shows, mm-hmm. because I believe, no disrespect intended, that I will win the argument of ideas. And I think that if people just hear me without you on the show, and I go and I talk about the Civil War in Iraq and everything, they'll say, that's Mark, he's a Democrat, he's trying to promote his views. But by bringing you on the show, what it does, and listen, I have an agenda here. I want people to agree with my agenda. I think by bringing you on the show, by showing that you give me your best arguments, some of them are good, but I think I come back at you, the people understand that, hey, well, Mark maybe has some good ideas. Mike threw his best at him, and he came back. I think the president would do well to learn the same lesson. If he truly believes in what he's saying, and he's not some puppet put up there by Karl Rove and Dick Cheney, which I wonder about, if he truly believes in what he's saying, he should welcome the opportunity to have someone come in, confront him, and in a dignified, intelligent manner say, you're wrong, and let me tell you why. This president isn't doing that.
Well, it'll surprise you, Mark, to know that I, too, have an agenda.
And I know that.
I'm as delusional as you are to think that I win all the arguments, as you're delusional to think you win them all.
Fair enough.
And so we have fun.
Why isn't the president confident enough to take on someone who disagrees with him?
Well, it's not that he's not confident enough, but we'll talk about that. But if he doesn't need to, when the president of the United States talks, people listen. It's, you know, like the old E.F. Hutton commercials or whoever it was. He doesn't need to have someone on to make it look good, to make it, to draw an audience. He draws an audience just by himself. And
it would draw an audience.
And in terms of being challenged and doing that, well, normally a president only does that during a campaign. And he did debate Senator Kerry. They had their standard three debates during the campaign.
Whether he had a mic connected at his back or not will always remain with the conspiracy theorists.
Once every so often, he does hold a press conference. My personal opinion is he ought to hold a press conference more often because I think
once a year, twice a year.
Well, no, he's
including the least in modern times.
My advice to him would be,
has had less of a press conference than George W. Bush.
My advice to him would be to have press conferences more often because. The standard rap on him is that he doesn't do that well on his feet, and I think he does just fine on his feet, and I think he ought to be out there selling himself in a give and take with the press. I didn't have coffee with him this morning, but if I did, I would have told him that.
Well, I'll tell you, I think the standard rap is right. I don't think he does very good on his feet. I don't think he really follows policy that closely. I have to believe, you know, you're going to hate this, but I think he's a trained monkey. I really do. I think that George W. Bush is someone who's told what to say by Karl Rove, by Dick Cheney, who I do think are intelligent. And I'm not saying he's a moron, but I do think that he's someone who learns certain spin bites, unlike you, who I think actually, you do some spin bites, but you actually give reasons for what you have to say. This is a guy who's being told what to say, and he has to memorize all the things that come back. And you know what? It takes longer to prepare for a press conference when you don't know what's going on. You have to memorize all the spin bites, have all that training, all the debate, when you actually know what's going on. I think there's a clear reason why George Bush doesn't have those debates. And I think I want a president, whatever their view, who's able to sit there and defend their policies against all comers. You know, the last one that was really good is Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy loved press conferences. John F. Kennedy, every time he could, like every 2 weeks, he would have a press conference. He would have people throw at him everything, and he would enjoy.
Yes, it was a just big give and take.
I think you and I enjoy the challenge. We enjoy the tough questions. We enjoy, you know, showing back what we believe. And I think that comes with the confidence of believing we're right. Not that we, you know, not that you're right or right about everything, but we believe we're right.
We have fun doing it, and Jack Kennedy had fun doing it. And there
why
has
doesn't
been,
Bush do it?
Because there's been an adversary. There's been an adversary relationship between the between the president and the press for a long time. It didn't start with Bush or Clinton. I mean, it goes back. For a long time. It wasn't there with Jack Kennedy. They like to mix it up, but it wasn't an adversarial relationship. As far as your comments about you know, the spin bites and being trained in the spin bites, everyone who goes out there, the president included, before he goes out to face the press or the public or whomever, goes through intensive briefings as to what messages will work, what messages will sell. I mean, even at my level, right now I'm working very, very closely with a candidate who's running for the city council in Alexandria. Every time we're going out to a neighborhood community meeting, I spend about 2 or 3 hours with him going over what's likely to come up, what a good thing to say is on this one, et cetera. Now, ultimately, the candidates don't just take the sound bites. They say what they want to say and what they believe, and the president says what he believes, but he doesn't. But as far as specific wording is concerned, every candidate, including presidents and all of them in the back, get their training and their spin bites and their practice before they go out and face them.
The problem is when this president hasn't had the training for his once a year or twice a year press conferences, he says silly things.
He would do better if
Brownie,
he did it.
Brownie, you did a heck of a job.
Well,
he says, we had no idea the levies could be breached, and now we have a video from the AP showing, guess what? He's a liar.
No, we don't.
This president... Okay, if he can't remember what are lies and what are the truth, because he doesn't say what the truth is. He says what his advisors tell him to say.
Your mistake was you read the first story from the AP where they got it wrong, and they did issue a correction.
I saw the video.
You saw the correction 2 days later.
I saw the video.
All right. What the video said, he sat there and he listened to a briefing where they said the levees could overflow. There's a big difference between overflowing and breaching the levees, and he was never briefed that they were worried at all. In fact, they weren't worried about the breaching of the levees. They were worried about overflow. And you're talking about, you know, that's the difference between night and day is an overflow and a breach. It really is.
Well, the Army Corps of Engineers was worried about a breach.
Okay.
And I'd be surprised if it didn't go up to the president, it should have.
But it took the AP 2 days to correct their story after they put it out there.
Toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-MARK. We welcome your calls, as you know, whether you agree or disagree with Mike or me. Or you can comment on the blog. Just go to www.radioinsidescoop.com and put whatever comment you like. And I want to read a comment from the blog. Let's go right to the website at RadioInsideScoop.com. This is from Robert, who I know is from Nebraska, but I also know he's a Democrat because he's a frequent listener on the show. And he wants to know if Mike Lane supported Dukester Cunningham in the past. Mike?
I know Duke. I wouldn't say that he was a personal friend of mine, but I'd met him on several occasions, and the answer is yes, I did support him in the past. Given what we now know about former Congressman Cunningham, I can say that my disappointment is among the highest of those out there.
Another question from Robert, and that has to do with the port deal, and we discussed this at length a month ago. And at that time, you were standing solidly behind the president on this port deal.
Right.
I have to tell you, your party has deserted you, at least on your position a month ago. Seven out of ten Republicans think the port security deal is a bad deal. Are you thinking now that maybe you'd advise your clients to if they were running in November 2006, they better come out against this port deal?
Mark, you asked me a month ago what I thought, not what I would tell my clients
say. So you're telling me you think the port deal is still okay, but you'd advise your clients not to vote for it?
I don't know. I don't know where we're going on this. My advice to them would be to hold their powder dry. Let's see where this goes. I still personally believe that there's no problem with this deal. We found out just last week that the Saudis have a contract where they run terminals on 22 of our ports, or 22 North American ports, most of which are ours, a couple of which are Canadian. But if the Saudis can do it, why can't the UAE do it? And that's been going on since 1997, and guess what? It was President Clinton's administration that approved that one.
Now, there's a difference between running a terminal, running a dock,
right,
and controlling the overall port.
Well, that's all the UAE is doing. They're just running a couple terminals on each port. They're not going to run the entire Philadelphia or the entire New York or the entire Baltimore or the entire Louisiana New Orleans port. They're just running a couple terminals on those ports.
It's a lot more than a couple terminals. I don't have the the documents I had from your last month, but my understanding, it was something like 60%.
Look,
that's not a couple terminals.
But what you and other people are worried about is a bad guy slipping something in through any given terminal that they're running, and all they got to do is run one terminal to have somebody slip in through that one.
No,
so it doesn't really matter the size of it to me.
Yes, because they're in overall charge of our ports. They are the ones to whom everyone will report to. Now, I understand they have to go through American security as well, but it seems to me that when you have a country that is in bed with Osama bin Laden, or at least was as recently as 5 years ago, supported the Taliban, gave funds to the killers that murdered 3,000 Americans.
Right.
To me, there's an argument that you could even invade the UAE since they were so much closer to Osama bin Laden than Iraq. I'm not supporting that, just like I didn't support the invasion of Iraq.
Good.
But
I wouldn't support that either.
It seems to me that at the end of the day, I want Americans to control American ports. If I have to, you know, I'll trust some Canadians, the British, but I'm certainly not going to trust the UAE. We Democrats, I have to say, my very first program 2.5 years ago was on port security.
It was a hot topic back then.
Well, it really wasn't. I'll tell you. I talked about it 2.5 years ago. The Democrats talked about it. I worked on the committee overseeing Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. We talked about it. We talked about the fact that still shocks me, that if you go on a plane, they take your shoes off, but if you mail a package, it can go underneath an airplane and blow up. And they're still not doing anything about that. I hope they are now, for all our sakes. I don't work on the committee anymore. But this is a major problem. And it seems to me that one reason why 7 out of 10 Republicans are deserting the president on this issue is because the president, at least among Republicans, was trusted for security.
Right.
And now they're learning that that's an empty promise.
Well, it's not an empty promise. In fact, as we have previously discussed, and as I hope most of our listeners know, the UAE, in operating the terminals in these six ports, is not in charge of security. Security is being carried out by the United States Coast Guard, the United States Customs Service, and the United States Department of Homeland Security. Those are the people who provide the security for the ports. They're scheduling the longshoremen in to load and unload the boats. They're scheduling the boats into the docks or keeping them at sea. That's what operating terminals consists of.
They're
not providing the security.
They're deciding who can come in and who can leave. That is a major
role. Well, they're deciding what ships come
role.
In. Right, right.
That's right.
Of course.
And they can plan the time, and they can plan. And it would not surprise me if right in the UAE are more people out to harm the United States than are in Iraq today. That this is a government that is not, I mean, does not want to trade with Israel, has never been a friend of the United States. I don't believe they're a good friend now. I don't want them controlling who comes in and out of our ports.
It's not that they're not a good friend. Historically, they have not been close to us. I admit
they've been our enemies.
Historically, they've played both sides of the fence. And that's not atypical for that region. They do these things over there. That's their culture, is to play both sides of the fence. The knife goes in the back of the guy who's not looking. When the president reacted after 9/11 and said, "Okay, world, time to take a big breath here. You're either with us or you're against us, but there's no middle ground." The evidence is that the UAE decided they were with us at that point.
Mike, we have only a few seconds left. I want to quickly turn to the president's budget. In the budget is an idea to develop new nuclear weapons and to cut student loans. Do you think these are good budget priorities?
Well, I don't think that those are necessarily direct trade-offs. The fact is there are a lot of student loans that aren't being used out there. Maybe they could be marked. Yeah, we have all the Pell money is never used. It's just sitting there.
Well, I know a lot of people who's getting their Pell grants cut, and they don't feel that way. They want their money. It seems to me if we believe in equal opportunity, if we believe that every American should have a chance to succeed, we've got to support student loans. We've got to support getting kids into college. Mike, I'm afraid that's it. I get the last word today. You'll get the last word on another show. Thank you very much for coming into the Inside Scoop. Thank you for all your calls. Tune in next week, 7 o'clock, for another edition of the Inside Scoop.
We clear?
I didn't hear music at the end.
I would have liked a little bit of music in there. Other than that, it was a great show. Well, and other than your mic mishap at the beginning.
That's it. Only was the first 3 minutes, 4 minutes.
That was good. I enjoyed that one.
Thank you, sir.
I always enjoy our debate.
We did good.
And that was really nice what your friend Pat said. Sorry to turn it into a bad Republican.
Pat's a Democrat. He's, in fact, I didn't know what he was, and he's a very reasonable Democrat. Mm-hmm. And when I was party chairman, I tried to recruit him to run as a Republican. And I said, "Well, I appreciate the offer, but I'm a Democrat, you know."
But, you know, I really think if the president would sit down and really debate the people who disagree with him. Why should he even debate them? I mean, what's he going to do? Go on
TV and debate John Kerry again? The election's over. I'm not saying that.
Debate Americans. You know, frankly, it's a lot easier to beat up on a guy in an audience than on. You have all the advantages there. You don't have as knowledgeable a person on the other side. They don't have equal time to you. They get to ask a question, then they have to shut up. They'll do the best.